Welcome back, dear students, to our second presentation on stocks. And we're going to now take a look at where stocks are actually traded, how this thing works, this whole system works. And then we'll begin the process, just tiny little baby steps on how to value companies, how to research, and what numeric measures we use to determine whether a company is a good investment or not. Okay, so let's start on slide number 18. Where are stocks traded? Well, for many years, hundreds of years, there were securities exchanges, they were called. And securities is just a fancy term for financial investments. I know our introduction to investments class used to be called Introduction to Securities, and people would say, no, we used to be called Investments and Securities, and people would say, I'm not an administration of justice major. No, not that type of security. No, so stocks are just one type of security, tradable financial investments. So for many, 100, 200 years, the granddaddy of them all in the United States was the New York Stock Exchange, the NYSE, the big board. It's now owned by a trading firm in Atlanta. Huh? And then right down the block was the American Stock Exchange, the Amex, the Curb. The Curb? Yeah, they started outside on the street, on the curb of the New York Stock Exchange. Then they moved down the street, and now they're owned by the New York Stock Exchange. And they're no longer called the Amex. They're called the NYSE, New York Stock Exchange, American Exchange. But you know what? These things are all electronic now. There's still some transactions that occur on the floor of the exchange where people used to be running around screaming and hollering, and now they're all standing and looking at talking to one another and looking at video screens. I think the only reason they keep the New York Stock Exchange floor open is for television. I'm pretty sure. And there's this one guy who's very photogenic. He has a beautiful goatee and white hair, and he's got he just looks very businesslike. So I think that's the reason they keep it around. And he sadly caught COVID and was very, very ill. And the whole investment community throughout the United States was rooting for him. I forget his name, Paul something Tuchman, I think, or Phil Tuchman. Well, guess what? A third entity came along called the NASDAQ. And it used to stand for National Association of Securities Dealers Automated Quotation System, but nobody remembers that. They just called it the NASDAQ. And this was totally electronic. So the New York Stock Exchange just poo-pooed them. This is not where the real companies are traded. No, we're the big board. We're the General Electrics and the General Motors and the Exxons and the McDonald's of the Coca-Colas of the world are traded. Well, the technology companies starting in the 1970s and 1980s kind of figured that they liked the NASDAQ better, and you might have heard of some of these little mom-and-pop companies like Apple and Microsoft and Google. And yeah, right. So now it's a two-horse race, basically, between the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ. The New York Stock Exchange is still bigger than the NASDAQ, but not that much bigger. But the world's largest companies, Google, Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, are on the NASDAQ. And then there's the wrong side of the streets, the wrong side of town, the wrong side of the tracks, the red light district. They don't call it pink sheets. They call them red sheets. They call them pink sheets. The over-the-counter markets. And the bulletin board has disappeared and has been rolled into the pink sheets. And it got its name from the fact that they used to publish a newspaper with thousands of quotes of sham companies on pink newspaper. That's why they called them the pink sheets. Look, stay far away from these things, okay? You hear someone say, I got this stock on the bulletin board, on the pink sheets, on the overview. You say, no, I don't want anything to do with it. You're being scammed. Stay away. Buy on the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, and maybe you're going to buy a small company on the American Exchange, but doubtful. But you don't even know you're doing it, do you? No, you're just enter the, you talk to your broker or you enter the trade on your computer and you don't know what happens after that. It's all electronic now. Slide number 19. To gauge the current condition of stocks in general, financial professionals have created various stock market indices, indexes, lists. That's all they are. It's just a list of stocks. And you can't help but hear about this every day. The Dow went up. The Dow went down. What's the Dow? The Dow Jones Industrial Average. But folks, most of the stocks on the Dow Jones Industrial Average are not industrial companies anymore. There's drug companies and there's McDonald's and Coca-Cola and there's what else? Insurance companies. I mean, they're not industrial. There's a few industrials, Caterpillar and the like. But But this is the oldest one, 1896. Actually, it's not the oldest one. It's Transport Index is actually a little older. But this is the one that ever you hear about on the news every day. But it's actually not a very good one. Unfortunately, it's the most popular. But the problem is there's only 30 stocks. So one stock does really well, the index looks like it did really well. Whereas if one stock does really, really badly, the index looks like it's done badly. And in the face-to-face class, we would stop and do a little exercise 88 years ago. Let's say you bought one company. I'm going to give you $10,000. And which company would you buy? So, not right now, but do that little exercise because it's a little bit of an eye-opener in terms of what stocks can do for us or not do for us. The better index, in my humble opinion, is the Standard & Poor's 500. This is the 500 largest companies in the United States. But even this index has problems. And what is that? The top 10 companies make up 30% of the index. The next 490 companies make up 70%. You see, what happens in these indices is that the bigger the company, the more weight, the more oomph it has in how the index performs. So if you have just a few tiny little companies that are huge, I'm sorry, not tiny companies, huge companies, which are, but only a few of them, you wind up getting some weird results, which is what we've had in the past and what I think we have right now. The third one that you'll hear about on the news is the NASDAQ. And that's because it's mostly comprised of high-tech companies. Not all. I mean, Costco and Starbucks are on the NASDAQ. But most of the companies there are high-tech companies. So people will look to the NASDAQ to see how the technology sector of the economy is doing. Now, these other ones are not that important, but we're going to come back to them maybe a little bit when we get to mutual funds because they are important for mutual fund investors. And so when we get to chapter 14, we'll revisit these guys because there's a lot of buzz around what are called index funds. Now, this one used to be called the Wilshire 5000. And because it was about 5,000 stocks, it went up to about 6,000. Now it's down to about 4,000. But Dow Jones somehow finagled Wilshire and got them out of the business somehow. It paid them off maybe. I don't know how they did it. But now it's called the Dow Jones U.S. Total Stock Market Index. Isn't that a great name? Goofballs. Wilshire 5000, so much easier. So that's a gauge of the entire stock market because we have large companies and medium companies and small companies. Okay, so that's interesting, isn't it? But the 500 companies in the in the Standard & Poor's 500 make up 80% of the entire market. So the small companies and the medium-sized companies are actually very, very small compared to the big boys and girls. The Russell 2000 is 2,000 stocks that are mostly all small and medium-sized companies. So that's trying to show you how the small companies and the medium-sized companies are doing. But so far, the five that we looked at are all domestic-based in the United States. What's going on outside the United States? Well, for many years, the two major indices were the World Index, MSCI. What does that stand? Morgan Stanley Capital International. Folks, you don't have to remember that. You'll just see MSCI. It stands for Morgan Stanley Capital International. And there's a bit of a story behind how that was created, but we're not going to go there. And then there was the IFA. And some people call it the IFI, but you hear mostly IFA. Europe, Australia, and the Far East. In other words, the World Index was meant to say, meant to show what's going on within the entire world, the global, todo el mundo. But the IFA was meant to show what was going on outside the United States. Well, the problem with these two indices is Morgan Stanley Capital International, which is the entity that actually oversees the index, chooses which companies belong and which companies don't belong, never changed them. They didn't make room for the emerging markets, the Mexico's and Brazil's and Turkey and South Africa and Eastern Europe and Africa and the Philippines, India, China. They just didn't bother. What they did is created two new indices, the MSCI All Country World Index for the entire globe and the MSCI All Country World Index ex-USA. Somebody got paid a lot of money to come up with these dumb names, but there you have it. And so these are the most important. And in the Business 123 Introduction to Investments class, we asked you to memorize these. We will just ask you to identify them in any potential exam. So as long as you can identify them, right, we'll give you the names. You don't have to come up with the names. Okay, 21. You've heard of bull markets. Have you heard of bear markets? Well, in bull markets, investors are optimistic. Stock prices are going up. The economy's growing. Things are great. Yippee! A bear market is the exact opposite. Investors are pessimistic. More investors are selling stock. The stock market's declining. The economy might be in a recession. No good, very bad day for the economy nor the stock market. And we normally define that as a 20% or more decline. If the market just goes down 5 or 10 or 15%, that's called a correction. And where do these names come from? You know, there's a lot of ideas about where they came from, but nobody really knows for sure. Bulls charge ahead, right? They throw their opponents up in the air, where bears are more reclusive, and when they attack, they knock their opponents down. Those aren't the real answers, but it's good enough. Just remember, bulls go forward and up, bears backward and down. Slide 22. Okay, let's start. Where do we start with stock analysis? Well, the author of The Intelligent Investor, a book that you eventually want to read if you are going to be investing in stocks on your own, but don't read it as your first book. There are much better books to start with, including Introduction to Investments, a free manual for building wealth, taught here at Southwestern Community College, written by yours truly. It's free. Just go on my website, wonderprofessor.com, and it's the third, I think, link on the left-hand side. Anyway, Benjamin Graham said, show me the numbers. Yeah, okay, show me the numbers. Well, the problem is there are dozens and dozens of numeric measures. And this is before Show Me the Money, you know, in the movie where they said, show me the money. There are dozens and dozens of these things. So we're just going to take a look at just a few, the most important ones. Capitalization. What a great name, right? What does it mean? It means how much your company is worth. Book value. That's how much your company is worth on the books, according to the accountants. And it usually has no similarity to what the company is actually worth, what investors are willing to pay for it. And there's a reason for that. Especially if you've taken accounting, you understand depreciation. Earnings per share. How much money is each little share earning? You can think of each share as like a little factory, a little business that's earning a certain amount of money. And then we compare the earnings to the price with the all-important price-to-earnings ratio. And then if they're paying dividends, we take a look at the dividend yield. We say, okay, how much is this stock paying us as a percentage of its market value? And that allows us to compare it to bonds, which are loans or savings accounts and other types of interest-paying investments. Now, it's not interest, it's dividends, and it's optional, But as we said, some companies have been paying dividends for 100 years. So let's first take a look at capitalization. Capitalization is very important. See, people key on the price. And that's okay, but it doesn't give you the whole picture. The price alone is meaningless, unless you get down to these penny stocks that are 7 cents or 5 cents or whatever. It's a very simple calculation, and we don't have to do it. It's done for us. We just look it up on the Infernal Net. But the number of shares outstanding times the current price of the stock. Now you know how much the company is actually worth, according to investors which are buying and selling the stock every day. Yeah, now you know what the company is worth. Until you see the price, you don't know what it's worth. You know, it's just, okay, it's $20. Oh, it's $100. That must be worth more. Not necessarily. The company that's selling for $100 a share might have far fewer shares, in which case the company is worth less, and the company has $20 a share that has far more shares. And we'll see some examples. There are three categories: the papa bears, the mama bears, and the baby bears. I don't know if that helps. I don't know. The large cap stocks, these are typically greater than 10, 15, 20 billion with a B dollars. We've got some companies that are worth more than $1 trillion. Folks, you and I have no way to even begin to understand how much a trillion is. It just doesn't work in our brains. A million is enough, right? A billion is 1,000 times that. And then a trillion is 1,000 times a billion. Anyway, then there are some mega cap stocks. Anything over $100 billion is a very expensive company, a very well capitalized, worth a lot of money. Those are the big, remember the blue chip companies, right? The Johnson & Johnsons of the world, the Exxon Mobils. Now, the mega cap is a subset of large cap. The mid cap stocks, many of them you've heard, most of them you haven't. And they're between 5 or 6 billion up to about 15 billion, depends on who you talk to. Some people say it ends at 10, some people say it starts at 2 or 3, but we'll do 5 or 6 billion to 15 billion. And then there are the small cap stocks, up to about 5 or 6 billion, which again, that's a lot of money, but to you and me it is. But in the world of publicly traded companies, no, they're small companies. And once you get down below about 100 million, 50 million, you get into the world of micro cap stocks. It's a subset of small cap stocks, but they're still called small cap stocks. Most of these you've never heard of, and let's hope that they make it to the big time, but a lot of them just disappear into a pool of tears. And then, not to be discussed in polite company, are the penny stocks. These are the stocks. Now, the typical definition is anything less than a dollar up to $5. But that's, you know, that some companies that are under $5 are, they might be hit on hard times, but they're not necessarily a penny stock. When I think of penny stocks, I think about these sham corporations that are selling for, you know, 0.7 cents or 12 cents or whatever. And they're just scam. They're just vehicles for people to steal money from you. So stay away. And if you're so inclined, look on the website, look in Canvas, and you'll see some examples of these penny stocks that were just scam. And if you watched Boilerplate or The Wolf of Wall Street, I didn't really watch all of Wolf of Wall Street. It's pretty raw, but it's fairly accurate. When he first starts doing his scams, he knows that this company is a scam, but he sells it anyway to people, and then eventually, they own most of the shares, the brokerage firm. So they're selling it to their clients who are being scammed. And then the brokerage firm dumps the shares at a high price and the share price plummets and you lose everything or most everything. Ugh. Anyway, so we'll take a look at some examples in a bit here. Here's the first example. So let's say the stock is selling for $50. What's the company worth? Well, we don't know until we know the number of shares. So now we know that there are 2 million shares. So we take $50 times 2 million shares, $50 price times 2 million shares, and that gives us $100 million worth of market capitalization. This is a small cap stock. The price for the most part, until you get down to the 10 cent range, you know, the penny stocks, is irrelevant. You must look at the market capitalization to see what the value of the company is. And we'll see some examples. But let's say you like this company. If you wanted to own the entire company, you would have to have $100 million in your pocket and run down to the New York Stock Exchange or the NASDAQ, wherever it was selling, and say, I want to buy this company. Well, actually, it doesn't work that way. You'd need probably $120 million, because you have to pay a premium when you take the company private, or one company takes over another company, buys out another company. You have to offer a premium. Why? Because if you started buying all the shares that are offered at any price, the price is going to start going way up, and everybody's going to be looking around. What's going on? Somebody's buying every share that we offer, because usually they're yelling and screaming at one another. It's all electronic now. You're yelling and screaming through your computer. I won't pay that price. I'll pay you this price. Oh, no, no. I won't accept that price. You have to pay me this price. But if you all of a sudden started taking every ask, transaction that was offered, then the price would start rising exponentially. And obviously that we don't want that, because then you're going to wind up spending a whole lot more for the company. So they do what's called a tender offer. And if you're so inclined, type tender offer or takeover, or one company buys another company into any search engine, and see how it works. Because it's very interesting, I think. Sometimes there are hostile takeovers, and sometimes there are takeovers like Elon Musk, who said he would buy Twitter for a certain price, and then when he signed all the documents, then when he realized what he was buying, he said, I want to get out of it! I want to get out of it! And they said, nope, sorry, you signed. So now he bought it, and now he's stuck, and he's not too happy about it. But he's now trying to turn it around and turn it into something profitable, and I wish him luck, but it doesn't look good. I mean, I don't use the darn thing. I'm not interested in Titter or Bitter or whatever the darn name is called. But he was, and we wish him luck, right? Okay, he'll need it. Slide number 25, book value. Book value, what is book value? Well, see, the accountants have to keep track of all the assets. And so they have these methods that they call depreciation and generally accepted accounting principles. And if you've taken accounting, you kind of know what I'm talking about. Depreciation and the like. And so this is the same thing that we're used to in the business 121 principles of money management world, where we talked about assets minus liabilities. Right, same idea. It's the net worth of the company determined by deducting all the liabilities from the corporation's assets and dividing the remainder by the number of outstanding shares of stock. However, it is rarely close to the stock price. It's often 1/5 or 1/6 less, sometimes more. And why is that? Well, think about it, folks. A successful business is worth much more intact than if it were liquidated. Think about a pizza restaurant. I mean, how much are the assets worth, really? The big asset, I guess, is the pizza oven and all the pots and pans and the utensils and the fixtures and everything. But if it's a successful pizza shop, it's worth far more than the assets on the books. If, on the other hand, the stock price winds up lower than the book value, then there is a real danger of the company being raided for its assets and put out of business. And you've heard the names corporate raiders, takeover artists, private equity. They search for companies that are on the skids but have a lot of assets still on the books, and they swoop in, buy 50% plus one share, which means they run the company now. They sell off all the assets, pay off the debts, and walk away with cash in their pocket. That's capitalism. Now, if you had worked for this company for 22 years, and now you're out of a job, you wouldn't be so happy with capitalism, would you? You'd be kind of, why are they allowed to do this? This is ridiculous. They're evil. Well, they wouldn't even talk to you. But if you sat down next to an economist who was kind enough to try to explain it to you and say, look, you don't understand. In our capitalist society, the capital, which is a fancy word for resources, money and materials, was locked up in this company that was not using it efficiently. Like a farmer would want to plow under the plants from the year before, we want to plow this company under and unlock that capital, including the human capital. You, the employee, would be better served for the economy and hopefully for yourself by finding a different job that is more useful to the economy. Now, while you're trying to feed your family, that doesn't help very much, does it? That knowledge. So that is why we have unemployment insurance, dear students. We don't have unemployment insurance to pay people not to work. Obviously, some people game the system, and it's ridiculous. Why would they do that? They're going to be better off getting a new job. But we want that company to be plowed under. We want that capital to be unlocked because it makes for a more efficient economy and creates more wealth for everyone. But it's not perfect, right? And that's why we have people screaming and yelling at their erected representatives that these companies are evil when they're just doing what they're supposed to do. They're trying to unlock the capital that is being inefficiently utilized at that company. And eventually the company's going to go under anyway, so they're just trying to get ahead of the curve and make some money doing it. Okay, enough of that. Go talk to your economics professor. Okay, slide number 26. Come on, sweetheart. Move to the next slide, please. Got to talk nice to your computer. Earnings per share and price to earnings ratio. Now, the earnings per share both of these numbers are very important and watched very carefully by investors all around the world. This is the corporation's after-tax earnings divided by the number of outstanding shares of common stock. Growth-oriented investors, remember the growth stocks, look for growing earnings per share. And that's the name of the game. How much are they going to grow their earnings this year, next year? What's going on? They call it the whisper number. You know what everybody's, I think they're going to earn 30 cents. I think they're going to earn 31 cents. And if they earn 29 cents, everybody sells the stock. Then what we can do is we can compare the earnings to the price. We take the price of one share of stock divided by the earnings over the last 12 months, or sometimes they'll use the future estimated earnings. They don't know what it's really going to be. A low price-to-earnings ratio means the stock typically is less risky, whereas a high price-to-earnings ratio means that the stock is more risky, but it's a little bit more subtle than that, as we'll see. Why do we want to own a business? Why would we want to own a stock? Well, many people just worry about the price going up, but no. We own businesses because businesses are in business to earn money. And we can think of our one share of stock as a little factory, as a little business earning so many cents. And then hopefully paying us some dividends. Because remember, they can optionally take some of those earnings and send them to us in the form of a check. Well, they don't send checks anymore. It's all electronic, but you get the idea. Here's another example. The earnings of this company are $2,500,000. Well, sounds like a lot of money, and to you and me it is, but we don't know how many shares are outstanding. So if there were 5 million shares outstanding, you would take the 2,500,000 divided by 5 million, and each share is earning 50 cents. Every share you own was earning 50 cents. Cool, isn't it? Makes you think of it as a little factory, a little business, earning 50 cents each share. And so now we go back and look at the price of the stock. Let's say the stock was $10. We take the $10 price divided by the 50 cents earnings per share, and we get a P-E ratio. And that's how you'll see it written, P/E, or just P-E, not physical education, 20. $10 divided by 0.05 by 50 cents is 20. Now notice the dollars cancel. I hate that word, but they go away, and we're left with just 20. P PE is unitless. So don't put a dollar sign, don't put a percent sign. You can do it if you want. I'm not going to mark you wrong or anything. But PE stands alone. So is that high? Is that low? Well, it depends on who you talk to. Historically, a PE ratio of 20 or above was considered high and reserved only for the fastest growing stocks. A PE ratio of 5 to 15 was considered average. For almost 30 years, a PE ratio of 40 to 50 was not uncommon amongst growth stocks like $5, Starbucks, or Google, or Microsoft, or Apple. Once during the internet bubble, I will never forget, I looked down at the machine and it said that eBay's PE was 10,000. The parachutes had better be very large, because when the market falls, the PE ratios fall dramatically, and companies with high PE ratios fall the furthest because they're flying the highest. The bigger the party, the bigger the hangover. And this little piece of information, I probably shouldn't even tell you because it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but for some people, they think, well, is that important? Well, it depends. Again, as with anything, when we look at a company, it depends on who's looking at it. But the PE ratio essentially tells you what the market believes the prospects for a company are. A high PE ratio means that investors are excited about the prospects for the company. A low PE ratio means the investors are not too excited about the prospects for this company. Now, are they right? I don't know. We'll know in 3 to 5 years. That's the problem. You pay your money and you take your chances. And it also gives you an idea of how long it will take in years for the company to earn back its price. Not that that's important, but think about it. If you have a PE of 20, if nothing else changes, and it's always changing, it'll take 20 years to earn back that price. If we have 50 cents a share, it'll take 20 years to earn $10. If we have a PE of only 5, it'll only take, 5 years. If we have a PE of 10,000, it would take 10,000 years for eBay to earn back its price, which obviously never happened in eBay's stock, along with a bunch of others. At least in eBay's defense, they're still around. But most of the internet stocks are gone, folks. There's only a few left. Well, not a few, but the dozens and dozens of them in the late 1990s are all disappeared. And you probably never even heard of most of them, like MP3.com or DrCoop.com or TheGlobe.com or CMGI. You don't remember? You don't even know what I'm talking about. You've heard of AOL, though, haven't you? Yeah, it's still around, believe it or not. Dividend yield. Oh, my favorite. Dividends don't lie. The dividend is the yearly dollar amount of income generated by a stock divided by the current market price. Historically, dividend yields were in the 4, 5, 6% range. Why? Because stocks were considered far more risky than bonds, so you had better be getting a good dividend or you weren't interested in that stock. But now 2 to 3% is typical. And many aren't paying any dividends, the high growth stocks. The dividend yield allows you to compare stocks to other investments, such as savings accounts or bonds, as we'll see bonds next chapter. And dividends don't lie. That's money in your pocket. They used to send you a check, but not anymore. They don't send you a check anymore. It's all electronic. Slide number 31. Let's take a look at the example. So you bought this stock, and it's paying you $1.50 a year in dividends. Now, the price was $87.50. So it's a very simple calculation. You can look it up, but you can do it too. $1.50 dividends per year divided by $87.50 gives us a dividend yield of about 1.71%, which is better than some savings accounts, but banks are raising their savings accounts now. Thank you very much, banks. Only took you 20 years to do it. So that's the dividend yield. And we said dividends don't lie. So what do you think? Is this really that difficult? I submit to you that once you start looking at these measurements, you kind of go, no, it's not really that difficult at all, actually. Then what's the difficult part? about stocks. What's going to happen in the future, right? These are just telling us what happened in the past. So let's take a look at some examples. Here are two mom and pop shops where you can go and buy things. You've heard of Walmart and Costco, haven't you? Well, if you looked at the prices of the stock, you might think that, Walmart is worth less than Costco? Look at that, $151.26. This is of May 3rd, 2023. And Costco, $4.95. Well, the problem is we don't know how many shares are outstanding. Right, there are far more shares of Walmart than there are of Costco. The earnings per share are $4.27 for Walmart, but $13.26 for Costco. So look at the PEs. Very similar. And they're pretty high. 35.4 for Walmart, 36.4 for Costco. So what are they thinking? What are investors thinking? Investors are excited about both of these stocks. They're thinking, the future looks bright for both Walmart and Costco. Now, do you agree? That's what investing is all about. You have to use judgment. I think they're a little high, personally, considering that it looks like we're probably going to go through a recession. I don't know, but we'll see. That's why there's chocolate, vanilla, and some people like strawberry. Now, look at the book value. Whoa! Nowhere near the price. Is anybody going to liquidate Walmart or Costco? Sell off all the assets, pay off the debts? No. Investors are very happy that Walmart and Costco are in business and expect them to continue to stay in business. The dividends per share are $2.28 for Walmart, $4.08 for Costco. So as a percentage of the price, the dividend yield is 1.5% for Walmart and 0.83% for Costco. So Walmart's paying us a little bit better, but not a whole lot better, but still 1.5 as opposed to 0.83. But now here's the money pitch. Remember we said you have to know how many shares are outstanding? Right. $408 billion worth of market capitalization is Walmart. And Costco is not quite half, but almost half of what Walmart's worth. At $220 billion. Now, they're both large cap stocks. They're both actually mega cap. Anything above $100 billion is in that rarefied air, but there are more and more companies that are getting there. So both of these companies are worth hundreds of billions of dollars, which means if you actually wanted to buy Walmart, you'd have to have $408 billion in your pocket and walk on down to the New York. Well, as we said, it doesn't work that way. But still, no one's going to buy Walmart, by the way, so don't worry about that. But you now see, is this that difficult? No, the intellectual part, the emotional part, and the prediction for the future, that's what makes stock investing so difficult. Because if you were to put a gun to my head and say, Frank, would you buy either of these? I'd say, I'd buy both of them, but not at this price. I just think the price is too expensive. But that's me. Everyone's different. I think I like to buy bargains, and I don't think these are good bargains. But that doesn't mean you might think they're good bargains, right? So that's why there's chocolate and vanilla. I said that already. Chocolate and vanilla, and some people like strawberry. Slide number 33, McDonald's versus Yum Brands. You know who they are, Yum Brands. You don't? Kentucky Fried Rat, Taco Hell, and Pizza Crust. I'm sorry, Kentucky Fried Chicken, Taco Bell, and Pizza Crap. They're all owned by the same company. It's called Yum Brands. They originally called themselves Tricon, which is a really dumb name. But the symbol on the New York Stock Exchange was Yum, and they decided, hey, that's a good name for a company. They all used to be owned by PepsiCo. Pepsi used to own them. I think they still own a bunch of the shares. But you know, folks, there's a whole lot of money to be made selling people sugar, fat, and salt. But that's what people love. Looking at the price, you'd say, well, Yum Brands is half the size of McDonald's. No, it's actually much less. McDonald's, $296.04. Yum, $139.37. Earnings per share, $9.31. $4.59. So the PEs, again, 31.8, 30.4, pretty high. PE ratios are pretty high for both of these stocks, which means investors are kind of excited about the prospects for both McDonald's and Yum. Look at the book value. What's going on? Both these companies have taken on huge amounts of debt because they were able to borrow at 1%. Not anymore. And they're going to have to pay this back, you know. But nobody's going to want to try to put either of these companies out of business because they would owe more than the whatever the assets were on the books. But again, nobody's going to try to buy McDonald's or buy, maybe somebody might buy Yum because it's only $40 billion, $39 billion. But you see, the book value, this is where the accountants come in and say, well, yeah, they have negative equity because they took on so much debt. Now what we would do in the 123 class is we would say, are they able to pay that debt? Are they able to service that debt? And we learn some techniques about how to do that. Dividends, $6.08 from McDonald's, $2.42 for Yum Brands. So they're both paying around 2% for McDonald's and 1.7%. Respectable, not great, but respectable. But now, again, here's the money pitch. How much is McDonald's worth? $216 billion. Whereas Yum is one-fifth the size at only $39 billion. Interesting? Yeah, you intuitively would figure that McDonald's is worth more than Kentucky Fried Chicken. And of course, now once we see the numbers, we see that, oh yeah, yeah, McDonald's is worth far more than Kentucky Fried Chicken. Very interesting. Oh, by the way, if you are going to study Yum at all, you'll see that they broke themselves up a few years ago. The China portion of Yum Brands was doing gangbusters because it turns out the Chinese like chicken more than they like beef. Figure that one out. So the chicken Yum Brands China was doing really, really well. And then the bird flu came along and people stopped going to Kentucky Fried Chicken because of bird flu. Boy, oh boy. Slide number 34. AT&T and Verizon. Oh, you know these two companies, the duopoly, and they're fighting off T-Mobile, who's trying to steal their lunch. $17.17, $37.78. So you might think that Verizon is a whole lot bigger than AT&T. It is bigger, but not that much. Earnings per share, negative $1.15. Yeah, AT&T has been losing money. Why? Because they're spending a ton of money, and so is Verizon, trying to bring this 5G system out. You know, they're called the melting ice cubes, the telecommunications companies, because they have to continually spend billions and billions of dollars to upgrade their network every few years because a whole new system comes out. In the meanwhile, people don't want to spend more for their cell phones. They want to spend less than their cell phones. They want to spend less and less. So figure that one out. See how they work. Well, what's happening? Notice the PE for AT&T is not applicable. Well, once you're not earning any money, if you did calculate the PE, it would be negative. So they just put NA. Well, Verizon still is earning money, $5, but look at its PE, 7.5. Now, wait a minute. McDonald's was over 30, and Walmart was 34, and Costco was 33 or so. And you're telling me Verizon is only 7.5? Yeah. Are investors excited about the prospects for AT&T or Verizon? No. They're actually darn right pessimistic. Downright pessimistic because of the situation that they find themselves in. That everybody already has a cell phone, so they have to steal from each other, and they have to continually spend billions of dollars just to stay up with the current technology. It's a real tough situation. And look at the book value. AT&T's price is very close to the book value. Now, folks, nobody's going to come in and buy AT&T and liquidate the place, but still, it's getting scary. Verizon is not quite as bad. It's nowhere near, you know, 5, 6, 10 times as we saw the previous companies. But still, investors are not too excited about these companies. $1.11 dividends per share. Wait a minute, they're losing money, but they want to keep paying that dividend, even if they're losing money. And Verizon's paying $2.61. Look at the dividend yield. Both of them are paying more than 6%. This is more than they pay their bondholders. More than they're paying in interest payments. What at those dividends? Look at those dividends and dividend yields. Are investors excited about that? No, they're really not. They're not running to buy AT&T and Verizon for that dividend yield because they're afraid the companies are going to continue to shrink. They call it the melting ice cube. But they're still huge companies, by the way. Look, $123 billion for AT&T, $159 for Verizon. So, what have we learned? We've learned that there are some numeric measures, there are many more, that we can apply to a company and get a feel for what investors are thinking about the future of the company. But we can't really decide. We can't really know what's going to happen in the future because nobody knows. We have to make our judgment calls and say, yes, I'd be willing to buy Costco or Walmart, even at these high valuations. Or I'd be willing to buy AT&T and Verizon because look at those dividends. I'm just happy with those dividends. So, or maybe not. You know, that's judgment. And that's why, as we said, there's chocolate and vanilla and some people like strawberry. Cool. Are you excited? I hope so. I think so. If not, that's okay, because that's why there are people who work in the industry. But if you are, I told you, I'm telling you again, the industry needs you. You don't even need a 2-year degree. You don't need a 4-year degree. If a 2-year degree, they're happy to have you start as an entry-level person. With less than a 2-year degree, you can get your foot in the door through the internship. Take this class, you're taking it. Take 123, Introduction to Investments. Take a few more classes we offer, maybe business law, maybe introduction to business math, if your math is really bad, and maybe business 290, workplace experience. Get your foot in the door. The industry needs you. And did we mention that the salaries are higher than the national averages? I hope so. Remember, dear students, we want you to be awesome. We want you to be successful. We want you to be rich. And as I've mentioned, the industry needs more women, more minorities, bilingual, trilingual, multilingual, and they just adore veterans. So we'll see you in our third presentation about stocks, where we get even deeper into the world of analysis.